In 2011, a 21-year-old man named Joel applied to be on the Portuguese version of Secret Story. This is a game show where the goal is for the participants to guess each other's secrets. Joel's secret, though, was a shocking one. His secret? Meu pai é rebelde de Lisboa. My father is the Lisbon River. I'm your host, Caitlin, and this is Wicked, a true crime podcast. He claimed his father was the man who stabbed and disemboweled three sex workers in Portugal's capital city in the 90s, while two other sex workers were shot dead on the opposite shore of the Tagus River in the same time period. These murders shared striking similarities to four killings that took place between 1993 and 1997 in the Netherlands, Denmark, and the Czech Republic, all countries that border Germany. Investigators believed that after the killings in Portugal, the killer could have become a long-haul trucker. José Pedro Guedes, the man's father, confessed to three of these murders, but could not be prosecuted due to Portugal's statute of limitations and a lack of evidence. In the country of Portugal, there is a 20-year statute of limitations. Two police detectives from out of the country made their way to the shore town of New Bedford, Massachusetts in March of 1993. Portugal's federal law enforcement, known as the Polícia Judiciária, came all the way to the United States to gather information about a serial killer operating in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Meanwhile, the FBI sent two agents to Portugal. They were tasked with gathering information about the Lisbon Ripper, and these two agencies were convinced that they were looking for the same man. Demographics of the victims in the U.S. matched those of their victims. I'm sure you are wondering how killings in Portugal have anything to do with New England. Well, in order to answer that question, we have to rewind the hands of time to 1988. New Bedford, Massachusetts is a town a little over an hour from the Boston capital with about 95,000 citizens. It's nicknamed the Whaling City because back in the 1800s, it was known worldwide as a popular whaling port. It is known for its large seafood producing industry, being home to many successful musicians, and also for being a deeply rooted Portuguese American community. Their most popular cultural fair takes place every August, and it's known as the New Bedford Fest of the Blessed Sacrament. Despite the rich history of this town, New Bedford, like many big cities, is a hotbed for crime. Although the FBI has reported that Massachusetts crimes have decreased over the years, there is still a lot of gang-related activity in the New Bedford area. To this day, the Latin Kings primarily run the streets of New Bedford, and crimes such as drug trafficking, prostitution, shootings, and murder are not uncommon occurrences in some parts of the city. Back in 1988, when the crimes took place, New Bedford was having a growing problem with prostitution. Many of its citizens were poor, and many women turned to selling their bodies on the street to make a quick buck and put food on the table. And, as you know, many of those involved in prostitution are runaways. They have no family support and are no strangers to dabbling into drugs. Two major areas in New Bedford that contributed to the drug problem at the time were the South End and the Weld Square. Both of these places were riddled with drug dealers and sex workers who would frequent the bars or walk the sidewalks. Sadly, these women of the night were vulnerable. They were easy targets for the New Bedford highway killer. And like many serial killers who target sex workers, it was probably assumed that if these women were on the street, there would be no one to account for them. No one would care if the drug-addicted prostitute was dead because of how the public viewed them. These murders began in 1988, around the same time as the Route 8 killings 150 miles away. Connected? Maybe. It wouldn't be far-fetched. On July 2nd, 1988, a passing motorist noticed something strange while driving along Route 140 north in Freetown. He pulled over to get a closer look, and in the grass, about 30 to 50 feet from the side of the road, lay a badly beaten woman, undeniably deceased. The body would later be identified as Deborah Medeiros, a 29-year-old from Fall River, Massachusetts. She would be the first of 11 women who would go missing between July 1988 and March 1989 in New Bedford. As police scrambled to gather information and conduct what was now being considered a homicide investigation, another body was discovered. 36-year-old Nancy Paiva hadn't been seen since 1 a.m. on July 7, 1988. She and her boyfriend, Frankie Pina, had gotten into an argument earlier while out at a bar. Her and Frankie had a tumultuous relationship. A divorced mother of three, Nancy thought she found love again when she met Frankie. However, he was a drug dealer and an addict. He had mob connections, and he would eventually lead her down the same path. It didn't come as a shock that Nancy would have wanted to be alone for a bit, but 48 hours came and went, and no Nancy. So he took the drive to the New Bedford Police Department and filed a missing persons report. According to the book Shallow Graves, Detective John Dextridor happened to be walking through the station when Frankie was at the desk being interviewed by another officer. The detective found it bizarre for Frankie to even be there because he was never one to speak to the police. You see, Frankie, not surprisingly, had a long rap sheet that included drug trafficking, robbery, assault. He had served jail time before, so he sort of had this kind of street cred, and he would have definitely been labeled a snitch had they ever saw him there. But Frankie, of all people, was coming to the police for help. If Frankie, of all people, was coming to the police for help, then there must have been something seriously wrong, and the detective knew that. He could feel it in his gut. So they took the report, and a few weeks later, on July 30th, 1988, her body was found along Interstate 195. She would not be identified until the end of that year, though, because her body was unrecognizable, and DNA technology was just not what it is today. In the meantime, more women went missing and turned up dead. On November 8th, a highway crew made a grisly discovery. They found the body of a young woman on the side of the eastbound Reed Road ramp on 195. The woman would later be identified as 35-year-old Deborah Greenlum DeMello, who had been strangled. The saddest part about Deborah's case is that before addiction took hold of her and made her life spiral out of control, she was a wife and a mother. When photos of her were released, one of those photos happened to be on her wedding day. She had walked away from a prison work release program in Rhode Island back in June, and she hadn't been seen or heard from since. Deborah's case also brought a revelation to investigators. When she was found, police made a startling discovery. Nancy's clothes were found right by Deborah's body. Now there was a link, and the police knew without a shadow of a doubt they had a serial killer on the loose. Because of that, they created a task force just months into their investigation. State Troopers Marianne Dill and Jose Gonzalez were the lead investigators on the case. According to the Daily Mail, the New Bedford DA at the time, Ronald A. Pina, assigned himself as chief prosecutor of the case, and District Attorney Investigator Bob St. Jean. At the direction of Mr. St. Jean, the police department got a group of cadaver dogs to canvass the area of the highway. On November 29th, Don Mendez was found on the westbound Reed Road ramp off Interstate 95. Then on December 1st, the dogs found Deborah Lynn McConnell. She was found off of Route 140 northbound in Freetown. And Sandra Batello, who left home without a trace on the 11th of August 1988, was also found. 28-year-old Cape Cod woman named Rochelle DePirala had been found beaten to death near a gravel pit in North Dartmouth. The body of Robin Rhodes was found in March of 1989. She was believed to have gone missing sometime between March and April of 1988. Although she was not involved in prostitution, she knew many of the victims because she was friends with Mary Rose Santos, who was the first victim in 1989 to be found and was a sex worker. Mary Rose Santos was a married mother of two, and according to her friends, the family was struggling to stay afloat. To help pay the bills, Mary Rose began engaging in prostitution. Her husband had no idea she was doing this and became upset once he realized she was gone. Then there was 34-year-old Marilyn Cardoza Roberts and 19-year-old Christina Monteiro. They were neighbors and both shared a history of substance abuse. Marilyn was last seen in June of 1988. Marilyn's family was under the impression that she had moved to the West Coast to live with a family member, but they would soon learn that never happened. In December of 1988, her family reported her missing. She has not been found to this day, and neither has Christina, a young mother who had gone missing after a family christening. Detective Dextridor began to notice correlations with each of the victims. The women all seemingly disappeared in New Bedford, Massachusetts, their bodies being found in three neighboring towns and within miles of each other. The majority of them were of Portuguese descent. They were all vulnerable, at-risk women who had a history with law enforcement, whether it be that they engaged in prostitution or fell into a spiral of drug addiction. And these women had also been known to frequent bars that sold drugs. And that wasn't all. Detective Dextridor and his department would eventually find that many of them had a connection to one man, and this man was well known in the community because he was one of their own. This man was Kenneth Ponte. So a little bit about Kenneth. Kenneth was a local criminal defense attorney who also served as a deputy sheriff at one point. Before studying law, he shared a similar history to the New Bedford girls. His drug addiction didn't really seem to get better once he became an attorney, though. Because even though he was clean of heroin, he wasn't sober. He was making more money now than he had ever made. So like many, he resorted to a cocaine addiction and made company with sex workers. He began dating Rochelle Clifford DoPirala in 1988, but their relationship soured after a domestic violence incident in which he assaulted her and threatened her life. But he still stayed connected with Rochelle's mutual connections. And before Rochelle disappeared, Detective Drexador had been relying on Rochelle to testify in a case against Kenneth, where she witnessed him threatening to kill a man with a gun. But unfortunately, we know her fate. According to the Daily Mail, the girls on the street described him as weird and paranoid. He would bring them to his house, bolt the doors, and wouldn't let them leave. In spite of this, the girls didn't feel he was violent, especially because he didn't really seem interested in sex. The girls would continue to see him, likely because he fed their drug habit, end quote. But the connections were much deeper than drugs. In damning interviews, the workers would tell investigators that Kenneth had represented Mary Rose for a drug-related offense. This had taken place shortly before she had disappeared. He worked with Nancy. It was alleged that he had dated Robin and had at one point let her stay with him when she didn't have anywhere to go. His last tie was to Dawn, who had reportedly been seen knocking at his door. Police were now starting to connect the dots, and Ken was looking more and more like their killer. Their next task was to find Kenneth. He had moved to Newport Riche, Florida shortly after Rochelle's murder. In 1990, Kenneth was questioned and eventually arrested in the murder of Rochelle. While the Commonwealth went through the legal process, officials continued to try and link Ken to the other murders. A grand jury indicted him on the murder charges for Rochelle, but a year later they were dropped due to a lack of sufficient evidence. Any remaining drug charges he had were also dropped and the case went cold. This would be a huge blow to the investigation and to Rochelle's family. The reasoning for the charges being dropped was because there was another man who had been a suspect. His name was Anthony DeGrazia. A special prosecutor named Paul Vincent Buckley had been reviewing the case for months and concluded that Anthony was a stronger suspect than Kenneth was. According to a 1991 article in UPI, he stated, quote, "He is a strong suspect in my mind. In my mind, there was no evidence presented to the grand jury that Kenny Ponte was directly involved in the death of Rochelle Clifford DoPirala. Known as Tony on the streets, he was a construction worker in the area, but he was known to engage in prostitution and had a violent temper. Tony ended up on police's radar because he had been accused multiple times of being rough with the girls when having sex with them. Being in construction, he was obviously very strong, and it would be easy for him to overpower someone. It was well known amongst the girls to avoid the man who looked like a boxer. When Tony was interviewed, he denied killing anyone. Investigators asked if he was willing to take a lie detector test, and he agreed to it. But he did not show up for the scheduled test, which, of course, made him look bad. In May of 1989, law enforcement went to Weld Square, and while canvassing the area, police made contact with a 22-year-old sex worker named Margaret Medeiros. Margaret described an incident where a man tried to choke her. She described him as having a boxer-like build with a flat nose, which matched Tony's characteristics. When the detective showed her the photo of Anthony, she wasn't able to make a positive identification. She only said he kind of looked like the man who attacked her. Unfortunately, this kind of had set a precedent that would end badly. There was a secret jury meeting, and Margaret was asked to provide testimony. According to The Independent, she said this person named Tony, quote, "lunged at my throat and tried snapping my neck, and he told me what he was going to do to me, like he did to those other bitches." After this jury meeting, Tony was picked up for more questioning, then brought before the grand jury, but he was never indicted. Despite this, Attorney Pina asked the court to issue a warrant for Anthony's arrest, and it was granted. He was arrested and charged with 4 counts of rape, 6 counts of assault and battery, and 1 count of assault with intent to rape. His bail was set by Judge Edward Harrington at $180,000, the non-charity bond of $1 million. During those 13 months, he would appear in court 18 times due to the motions his defense attorney filed. The attorney requested numerous times for the court to produce documents of evidence. He also asked for a bail reduction for his client because of the lack of evidence being produced. The motions were denied each time. Anthony decided to fire his attorney and get a new one, Robert George. Attorney George filed a contempt case against the district attorney's office for non-production of evidence, and the judge had no choice but to lower Anthony's bail. He was finally released from jail on June 27, 1990, but it was short-lived. He was arrested for allegedly threatening to kill the judge for what he felt was wrongful prosecution and imprisonment. He again posted bond and was re-released. On July 27, 1991, Tony took his own life, just 2 days after it was disclosed that Special Prosecutor Paul Vincent Buckley planned to drop the murder charges against Kenneth Ponte. Tony's death has been disputed, in part because of the manner in which he died, and also because of the medical examiner's original ruling. Tony's body was found at his ex-girlfriend's parents' house in Freetown, Massachusetts, lying face down under a picnic table in their backyard. His death was ruled a homicide by Freetown police, and the medical examiner agreed. However, the district attorney's office later ruled his death a suicide. The autopsy report clearly does not support this decision made by the district attorney's office, but I can understand why they felt the way they did. They're right, it is very coincidental. But where the DA's office really screwed themselves was when they talked to the press. The court documents and in press releases, the DA and their press secretary made it very clear that they felt his death was a convenient way for him to avoid prosecution, essentially the coward's way out. When this happened, Anthony's mother, Diane Souza, filed in the federal district court, alleging that the Bristol County's DA and his press secretary violated Anthony's 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendment rights. The suit alleged in part, quote, Pina and his press secretary, appellant James Martin, conducted numerous press conferences and other media interviews in which they caused or encouraged the media to link DeGrazia to the highway killings case, end quote. The complaint further stated that the DA and the press secretary knew or should have known that DeGrazia would take his own life as a result of the statements in the media, and because they violated his constitutional rights, they denied him due process as well as their right to be free from, quote, arbitrary and brutal punishment, end quote. Was heard before the court on May 26, 1993, the defendant sought to dismiss the case under the guise of qualified immunity. They also felt his mother failed to state an actual claim. The motion was denied and subsequently went to the First District Court of Appeals. The judges agreed with the DA, and the decision by the lower court ended up being reversed. The cases for the highway killings went cold, and the media attention began to die down. That is, until May 2007, when a Fall River man named Daniel Tavares Jr. ended up on police's radar. I have to be honest with you, this guy has to be one of the most despicable human beings I have ever read about. From a very young age, Tavares was getting into trouble. His first brush with law enforcement was at 19, when he broke into a house in the middle of the night and attacked a man. He had people rallying around him, though. According to a 2013 article from the Boston Globe, a family friend named Richard Pires wrote a letter to the judge saying Tavares was a, quote, very sincere and honest young man. I do not believe that you will see this person in your court again once this ordeal is over, end quote. The man's statements would prove to be so wrong. Tavares would continue to commit crimes, mostly drug crimes, and be jailed for multiple parole violations. But then, in 1991, he would snap. Having just moved back to Massachusetts after a short stint in Florida and living in Somerset, Mass. With his mother, he was spiraling. On July 10, 1991, Daniel Tavares stabbed his mother at least 15 times with a carving knife, killing her in the home he shared with Norman Serrault and, ironically, Richard Pires. Yeah, the same man who had wrote a letter to the court. The same man who still had faith in him. Richard was stabbed while trying to subdue him. I can imagine he felt very betrayed after this. This man only served 16 years in prison. How? He was released in June of 2007, and how he did is beyond me because according to the LA Times, he, quote, repeatedly threatened to kill or maim his father, various state officials, and prison guards. His father called him pure evilness. In fact, he actually said at one point that if he could, he'd be the one to stick the needle in his son's arm should he receive the death penalty. Tavares suffered from severe mental illness. According to a CSI report written by Police Sergeant Bruce Gilson, investigators took, quote, an inventory of a veritable pharmacy of psychiatric meds in his bedroom, a squalid hole with soiled sheets on an air mattress, and chicken bones on the floor. Among the 14 vials kept by Tavares, police found flupenazine, which is prescribed for psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, dementia, and agitation. They also found Artane, a drug used for Parkinson's disease that also treats the side effects of medications prescribed to treat schizophrenia. I have no doubt the ridiculous amount of drugs he was on fueled his criminal tendencies and made him very sick. I can empathize with that. But regardless of whether he was mentally ill or not, there is no excuse for what he did. He should have never been released because it would prove to be a grave mistake. When Tavares was released from prison, he took off to Washington State. It was there, 2 weeks later, that he was arrested on suspicion of killing a young couple, Beverly and Brian Mauck, in the small rural town south of Seattle. What an epic fail on the judicial system's part. The Commonwealth rightfully received backlash
because politician Mitt Romney was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, the failure to protect the public from Daniel would come back to haunt him when he was running for the presidential election. I actually remember this, and it was a huge talking point during the debates. But in any case, Daniel was eventually convicted of those murders and sentenced to life in prison, continuing the same behaviors he did the first time around. But they escalated into something bigger. In a letter in which he threatened a prison guard, he indirectly claimed responsibility for the highway killings. In particular, he had knowledge of a woman named Gail Botello, who went missing in 1988. When investigators in Massachusetts caught wind of this, they obtained a warrant from a judge and exhumed the backyard of his old house. And he was telling the truth. Skeletal remains were found under a tree. Gail eventually got her name back through DNA testing and was given a proper burial. Tavares was convicted in 2015 for her murder and given a concurrent life sentence. In 2009, Kenneth Ponte's name resurfaced again. When Ken had been disbarred as an attorney after his charges, he went into hiding in Florida. Police were still investigating him in the highway killings, though, despite the charges against him being dropped, and they were able to obtain a search warrant on Ponte's old home to check the yard. They brought a backhoe there and dug up the driveway and patio, but were unable to find evidence linking Ponte to any crime. Ponte never really ceased his criminal activities. He was arrested multiple times for shoplifting and other petty thefts, just stupid minor crimes. But in 2010, at the age of 61, Ponte was found dead. He hadn't been seen or heard from in 2 days, prompting a family member to call the police to perform a wellness check. They responded to his home, and it was there that he was found deceased on the living room floor, taking his secrets and any information he may have had about the killings to his grave. He is presumed to have died from a heart attack. There has been a common quote I have heard in the legal community, and that is, quote, "A good attorney knows the law, a great attorney knows the judge." I have to wonder, did Kenneth Ponte persuade the court into believing he was innocent in the murder of his girlfriend? And was he able to use his power through money to get all eyes to turn away from the possibility of him being a serial killer? It sounds like a probable theory. When it comes to Anthony DeGrazia, I am appalled with the amount of times this man showed up to court for the same crime. It took the court 18 times in 15 months of this man being in prison to be released, with very little, if any, evidence pointing to him. I don't care whether the guy was a criminal or not, judicial misconduct is unacceptable. In this country, we are afforded the right to innocence until we are proven guilty in a court of law by a jury, and this case never made it to trial. So where do you draw that line? While this amendment is at the core of our justice system, it can come with what most of us perceive as a downside. You can have your guy right in front of you and have no choice but to let them walk because of evidentiary problems. Unfortunately, in this case, there was not enough evidence to convict anyone, and there were devastating consequences as a result. So who do I think is a highway killer? I honestly have no idea. All three of the men look bad in my book, but we will never get the truth out of two of them because they are gone. What I do know is that I do not believe that the highway killings are connected to a single person. Rather, I think there may be more than one person. Maybe it was a group that did it. Maybe all three men are guilty of killing certain women in this group somehow. Who knows? But the fact remains, there are loved ones of the victims that are never going to get closure, and the only thing that may help them is IDing the person or persons who committed these heinous crimes. So please, if you know something, say something. It doesn't matter how much time has gone by or if you think the information is useless. Sometimes what we perceive as the stupidest bit of information or the most minuscule could be an investigator's big break. If you have any information that could lead to the capture of the New Bedford Highway Killer, please contact Massachusetts State Police Sergeant Amory Robertson at 508-993-2016. Again, 508-993-2016. Calls will always be returned.